Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and what a great show we have for you today. Unusual for a Thursday. Usually we do it on a Friday, but scheduling being what it is, scheduling and whatnot, we're doing it on a Thursday this time, and that is a flannel panel when we get together with really smart people, and we talk about the news of the world from a Catholic perspective. And I think it's going to be an extra good episode of flannel panel today. First of all, I should tell you, though, before I introduce our guests for the day, you can call and become part of the conversation if you want. And there's probably a good low percentage chance that you'll get on, because we just tend to talk our way through this show. Well, we'll try to get you on, but we tend to just talk our way through it. The number is 888-318-7884. You want to talk about the church in the news? You want to talk about the news from a Catholic perspective? Doesn't have to have anything to do with the church. You know, maybe it's a new show or a political movement or something you want to talk about. 888-318-7884. And I will promise you at least a 15% chance that we'll get you on the air. A good part of the reason why I think this is going to be an especially good episode of the flannel panel is the director of publishing here at Catholic Answers is Todd Agliolaro. He's a well-read and erudite, and he probably even knows whether or not I'm pronouncing erudite correctly.
And silently judging you over it.
Right. Todd Agliolaro. Todd, thanks for being on the panel today.
Well, thanks for having me. Anything to get a new shirt.
Yeah, now, but the shirt has a little bit of a story with it. You are, first of all, appropriately attired in flannel for the flannel panel, which not everybody does. Not everybody comes to the flannel panel understanding that the word flannel refers to the garments. But tell us about that shirt that you're wearing.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's a second-class relic, this shirt. It was once the property of a wise and holy priest named Father Ray Ryland, who was the chaplain of Catholic Answers decades ago, mm-hmm. and the shirt lives on, and it was loaned to me this afternoon so that I'd be properly attired.
Yeah, you have the odor of holiness about you.
There's a little bit of odor of mothballs or something with it too.
But no, I thought that was holiness. All right, Father Ryland, the father of, in addition to being a holy priest, but the father of our own Tim Ryland,
indeed. Thanks for the shirt.
Also joining us for the flannel panel today, regular guest Joe Heschmeyer, who regularly neglects to wear flannel and did it again. What is the matter with you, Joe Heschmeyer?
I had a Halloween shirt. There were only so many days left I could wear it, and this was my last chance. And so I thought, well, I'm just tuned into the seasons. It's a very much a liturgical disposition. I also, I wondered if it was really going to be flannel panel without Chris, which, by the way, I loved how you said it's going to be an extra good episode because Chris wasn't going to be here.
I didn't say that.
He is at home.
I never made that connection. publicly, anyways. It is a lovely shirt. Skeletons, bats, jack-o'-lanterns, spiders, all of the and orange and black. So that's definitely a Halloween shirt.
It's subtle.
That's right. It's filled with subtlety. Again, the number is 888-318-7884. We're going to talk about all kinds of news. And there will be audio clips. And you know that I can't do flannel panel anymore without an audio clip from National Public Radio. Because it used to be, before we had flannel panel, I would be riding in the car. I would listen to something on National Public Radio. And I would just... I wouldn't have any other thing to do except just scream out the windows as I pass through Southern California.
By the way, we created an entire podcast network so people didn't have this experience.
Didn't have what experience?
Of having to listen to NPR and scream out the window.
Oh, I know, but sometimes I'm heading home, and I one of my dial destinations is National Public Radio, and I flicked it on myself sometimes. But now, when outrageous things are said on National Public Radio, I think I can play that for the flannel panel, and I have one for you. And I would, both of you being literary men. I mean, well, actually, Todd being a literary man, you being a guy in a Halloween shirt, I thought this would be...
that Venn diagram, I bet it's got some overlap.
I wanted to play this piece of audio from Silvia Poggioli. Do you know who Silvia Poggioli is? Do you know?
No.
No? She's the Rome reporter for National Public Radio. Silvia Poggioli. And she's everything you would expect at National Public Radio, and she's reporting in this little piece on Giorgia Meloni. You know who Giorgio Meloni is, Todd Aguilar. You don't.
I know who Giorgio Meloni is.
Giorgio Meloni is the new prime minister of what's that country? Italy.
Yeah,
Italy.
Italia. Yeah.
Italia. Yeah. And see, the claim is being made that she is a fascist. And the most common thing you hear after she was elected is the most fascist person to be Italian prime minister since Mussolini. So
since the guy who actually was literally a fascist.
Yeah, right. So the guilt by association is enormous. But I want you to hear Silvia Poggioli explaining one of the most important clues to why she's a fascist. Now, I have to admit, I don't know Giorgia Meloni. I don't know if she's a fascist or she's not a fascist. I just thought the reasoning here was something that would entertain both of you. So could we play Silvia Poggioli reporting from Rome on the new prime minister of Italy?
At a rally in Rome in 2019, right-wing party leader Giorgia Meloni forcefully told the world who she is.
Io sono Giorgia!
I am Giorgia. I'm a woman. I'm a mother. I'm Italian. I'm Christian, she said, and you're not going to take that away from me. As a teenager, Meloni dressed as a hobbit. Like many young Italians attracted to the legacy of fascism, Meloni was infatuated by the Lord of the Rings.
There you go. She enjoyed the Lord of the Rings.
That is an amazing series
of thoughts.
I
want to start with Todd. What do you think about that logic?
I'm trying to follow it there, yeah.
She dressed as a hobbit and she enjoyed
like
the Lord of the Rings.
Like many young Italians.
Like many young fascists.
Like many young fascist Italians, she dressed like a hobbit.
Right. So I don't even know what you call that kind of logic.
I'd almost have to hear it again. It didn't click with me there the first time. I didn't realize there was such a phenomenon as infatuation with the Lord of the Rings being bound up with fascism somehow.
Yeah, right. It's a sign of fascism. Were you aware of it, Joe?
Only because I'd seen numerous people making that same bizarre connection.
Oh, had
in
you?
Response to Meloni. I had. So I've seen multiple people suggest that because she likes Tolkien, who, by the way, was openly anti-fascist and has a beautiful scathing letter to
Hitler.
The Nazis.
I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think to Hitler.
Yeah, because they wanted to know if he was Jewish or not so they could decide whether to ban his books. And he said it was a shame he wasn't Jewish and just totally makes fun of them. Like, just sends them a very mocking letter back. And this is the guy that apparently all fascists secretly love. So.
Well, and considering how frequently it's alleged, not without reason, that the Lord of the Rings is a kind of allegory of the rise of Hitler and the desolation and Shire of the Shire at the end of the Lord of the Rings being a symbol of what happens when fascists take over. That kind of connection you made, I just can't fathom it.
You know a lot about Tolkien. You're kind of a Tolkien. I don't know if you would use the word scholar, but you've made a study of Tolkien and his time. So does that just come completely out of left field for you that National Public Radio used that as evidence of fascism?
The only thing I can think of is the connection that some people make between Tolkien's lore and an enthusiasm for Western values. The effect in the Peter Jackson films that were made, 20 years ago now, the actor who played Gimli, John Rhys Davies, was very vocal about that, and is a stalwart champion of Western civilization. But he held up Tolkien's work as a model for us of what's worth defending and what's worth fighting against.
Yeah.
So I guess if you're grooving to that way of thinking, and you're making the Lord of the Rings your symbol in that respect, I guess you could make that kind of perverse connection, but I can't see how otherwise.
Well, the Tolkien was a lover of German literature, German folklore, the Germanic kind of what would it be? The mythology of the Germans.
Yeah, from like the 13th century, not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, he sees this beauty in the German people and in their mythology and in their morality. And that makes him a fascist? Like, you can't like German.
A lot of fascists eat breakfast. And so I'm looking very suspiciously at people who.
Breakfast cereal.
Do morning meals. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's also an old racism canard that's applied to Tolkien because by and large, the good guys are northern and fair-skinned.
Oh, yeah.
And you have the evil Hara Dream of the South, and they're darker skin. I think that that's a crude way of interpreting it, but maybe that's it again, grasping at straws here.
I always thought that myself. I don't particularly like that aspect of Tolkien, that the color kind of thing that he does. But I always, to my mind, what he was doing was something about Christianity and Islam, kind of that seeped into his kind of worldview, and so the European looking people are more noble than the Arab looking people in his work. But does that make any sense to you or no?
It could be. I'm not aware of his ever having made that connection himself, but it could be.
Yeah. So I love Tolkien. I mean, absolutely devoured Tolkien over The Lord of the Rings, that is, over Easter vacation of my eighth grade year, and I've never recovered from it. So I put it to you, am I in danger of being a fascist? Am I already a fascist? How would you interpret that?
What is meant by fascist when people use this as a pejorative? I mean, the fascism is a notoriously difficult kind of term to define in the first place, because we use it for really four different governments. We use it for Mussolini in Italy. We use it for the government of Franco in Spain, Salazar in Portugal, and sometimes for Hitler in Germany. And
no, other than always for Hitler in Germany.
Nazism is often the term we use for.
Yeah,
gets
right.
Conflated with Nazism, but originally they meant different things.
I see what you mean. I got you. Yeah,
these were two different ideologies. So it'd be like if you just lumped like communism, Nazism, and some third or fourth thing, and then gave one title to all of it.
Yeah,
I don't think I would know what you meant. And so that's kind of the problem we've got with fascism, is that it's not a single coherent ideology. So to say what is or isn't the fascist principle. Is loving Italy fascist now? I mean, because
Is it?
I'm going to read you in total the remarks that are causing global headlines. She says, why is the Giorgia Meloni again. She says, why is the family an enemy? Because it is our identity. So they attack national identity. They attack religious identity. They attack gender identity. They attack family identity. I can't define myself as Italian, Christian, woman, mother. No, I must be citizen X. Gender X, parent one, parent two, I must be a number. Because when I'm only a number, when I no longer have an identity or roots, then I will be the perfect slave at the mercy of financial speculators, the perfect consumer. Now, I read that and see that as a scathing critique of global capitalism, of a kind of capitalism that removes any sense of like cultural identity, localism, et cetera. This is very much the thing anarchists were fighting about against the WTO in the late 90s in Seattle, right? Like, this is going to create a global monoculture where everyone is just treated as a consumer without an identity. Now, you could read that stuff about financial speculators as anti-Semitic if you want to, but I think you're kind of bringing that into it. I don't see anything she's actually said there or in any of the remarks I've seen, which admittedly, not a lot. Maybe there's some really scathing bit out there. But the stuff I've seen so far is remarkably unremarkable. I mean, it's good. It's a breath of fresh air to hear someone say something sane like there's such a thing as men and women, that it's okay to be proud of your country. You know, like those sorts of things. But to get from that to fascism, it seems like if you're going to use that definition of fascism, then everyone until very recently was a fascist.
Yeah, that's the thing, is you're using a word that really does. I mean, Mussolini was a really bad man and did really, really bad things. And that should never come back. And so if reading The Lord of the Rings is a sign of the reemergence of that, well, then no one should read The Lord of the Rings. But it's clearly not. So what are you doing that you're connecting these dots that don't connect? It's terrifying, actually. I mean, it's frightening to think that the words have become so disconnected from their meaning that they're just a free-form critique of anybody you want to critique.
Aren't we kind of inured against that from long experience now, these kinds of catch-all pejoratives that are just completely unmoored from, certainly from their origins?
Yeah, right.
I think in political discourse, the term neoconservative maybe doesn't have, or at least doesn't have anymore, the bite that fascist does. But there was a term that had a certain meaning in a historical context, It was liberals, a lot of them Jewish, who abandoned the left and the Democratic Party in favor of the right because of their opposition to communism.
Yeah.
And that morphed into almost any
anybody you know, I don't
insult
like.
You wanted it to be,
yeah, right.
Or any idea you didn't like, you could label it thusly. And it seems in this case, fascism, which is maybe the most flexible of all these terms that we've encountered lately with
right,
Antifa.
Ask somebody what is fascism, and you can describe it, but you can't define it. Most people could.
Well,
not.
And I think Trump probably had a lot to do with that too, and we conflate fascism and populism, and some of what that quote that Joe just read a minute ago is signifies an economically populist agenda, this kind of rage against inchoate globalism, but bound up with some of that populism is, and this gets back to the Colkin thing again, perhaps pride in where you've come from and what you are and your heritage, and I think in nations in Europe where they're paying extra close attention to their European Christian identity,
yeah.
And all the attendant things, family, traditional notions of gender identity, all of those things, and saying, hey, we're losing these things, whether we're losing them through invasive ideologies or invasive cultures. And we see politicians in Poland, in Hungary, and a few other countries that are ringing this bell a little bit. And their enemies, whatever their agendas, push back with that fascism label to discredit them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about it a little more. I do have to take this break. Just 2 points, and one that I'll ask you about when we get back, and that is that it does seem like it's really hard for any kind of movement to become permanently disreputable, so that you have people who will rehabilitate Stalin and Mao. You have people who will rehabilitate now Mussolini. That does go on. But it doesn't quite seem like the rehabilitation of Hitler will ever happen. So I want to ask you about that, about why Italians might not feel about Mussolini quite the way Germans would feel about Hitler. We'll do that when we come back. I do also want to point out, though, that the part where she dressed like a hobbit, I do think that should disqualify you for national leadership permanently, if you dress like a hobbit ever.
A quick shout out for my brother-in-law who dressed as a hobbit for a wedding once. So
I don't even want to know that story. We'll be right back with more of the Flannel Panel on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's Flannel Panel today. Flannel Panel is when we get to sit here and chat with really smart people about really hard things sometimes funny things, and having to do with the way the church is perceived in the news media, the way the actual troubles that the church gets herself into and sometimes gets herself back out of, and then the troubles of the world from a Catholic perspective. If you'd like to participate in that conversation, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. I do have to confess that I looked at Todd at the beginning of the show and I said, you know who Giorgio Meloni is, and it sounded to me and to Todd like I said George Meloni, and that it just sounded. And Todd looked at me like, George who? And Joe's like, I know who Giorgio Meloni is. So I apologize.
Why did they elect an Irishman as president of Prime Minister?
It sounds
of Italy.
Like it. Yeah.
So fun fact about Irish PMs: they last on average like 18 months, I think.
Do they?
So yeah. Everyone's acting like this is like the beginning of the end of democracy in Italy. And it's like, I mean,
nah. Yeah,
I think we're looking at roughly 3 semesters worth of leadership.
And as I said, I really don't like. I wouldn't claim to know anything about Georgia Meloni. I don't know how to do it with an Italian accent, but Meloni.
Got the hands going.
But, hit the eye a little
yeah, yeah, that's how you pronounce Italian. Just move your hands. Yeah, she's an attractive figure in the way she speaks. Like she speaks wonderfully and with boldness that you really is appealing. But I don't know who she is or what she's about. Like I don't want to claim to be defending her. I just think that when she's attacked in the American media for liking the Lord of the Rings and that being a sign of her fascism. Of her sneaky fascism that she's trying to hide from the world. But if you've got copies of Lord of the Rings at home, clearly you're not hiding it from us. We know what you're really up to. I think that's just bizarre. But
it's more than bizarre. I mean, I think it's dangerous because when you accuse everyone of being fascist,
right? What does it mean anymore?
You've just cried wolf so many times that when there are actual people that need to be spoken out against, there's nothing left to reach for. In the vocabulary, because you've used all the like harshest pejoratives against people for doing nothing.
Yeah.
So you're just left.
So what are you going to do when the real fascists come?
You know, the right does this too. When everyone's a socialist, so somebody's just a socialist, some are so or a communist even.
Yeah, yeah.
And it uses it by in that same way.
Right. Not everybody on the left is a communist. Right. Bernie Sanders is, but not everybody on the left is a communist. You know what? I said if people called, there was probably a 15% chance they would get on. And yet, one gentleman has bothered to call. So I want to put him on. Paul in Naples, Florida. You made it onto the flannel panel, Paul, which is a real rarity. So thanks for being here. I hope this is a good point.
Yeah, well, my point is I go to St. Anne's Catholic Church in Naples. And it's a wonderful, wonderful community. And a few years ago, we had Father Tom, who at one point, one Sunday, he got up and he spoke out against what was going on, against socialism, and he spoke out mainly against abortion. And afterwards, I went up and I thanked him. I said, Father, thank you for speaking out. More people should be speaking out. And he said, and then an usher came over and he said, well, the Father Tom said to me, he says, I'm a Democrat from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. He says, but I cannot support them anymore because they're the party of death. And that is the truth. And I wish more people would speak out. The other thing is, I think that the National Public Radio, I can't listen to it because well, they like to say socialism. I say it's communism because people are using socialism. That's a nice soft word compared to communism. So to me, all these people that are fascists or socialists, they're really communists. The other thing is...
Wait, that's like 4 things now. I don't know how many things we're going to do. You keep saying the other thing is. They're gonna be, go ahead, one more.
Okay. The usher at the church came up to Father Tom and said, oh, Father, you can't say that. And he said, I am as true as I can be to tell you what I just said, you know.
Yeah.
He was a wonderful priest, and he just died recently, unfortunately. But he was, I just don't see, and the other thing is, yeah, here I go, another one. Why does the Catholic Church come out against Biden and Pelosi, who are both Catholics? They should be excommunicated for what they're doing.
All right. I'm going to let Joe and Todd comment before there's another thing. But first of all, I listen to National Public Radio, and I have low blood pressure. I am one of those people that needs to get his blood pressure up. And people are always like looking at me going, why do you eat so much salt? That's bad for your blood pressure. No, I have low blood pressure. I need National Public Radio and salt on all my food. So what do you think about...
Which thing?
What the other thing. The other thing that Paul said. Just the one more thing.
You know, I think the kind of building on the point we made right before you took his call, fascism, communism, socialism, these ideas, these isms, these are systems. They aren't just person who has an idea I disagree with, or even a person who has a dangerous idea I disagree with.
Right.
And I think the danger is when we use them all interchangeably to just refer to people whose ideas I don't understand or I dislike or I reject, that's not shedding a lot of light on what anyone actually believes. I mean, if NPR is saying we need to have state-run economics where everyone has the same wage, then by all means, like, throw out the communist title. I think it's fair to say that they're left wing. I think they would own that to a certain extent. But when we start saying this is the economic ideology slash whatever we're calling fascism, I don't know. I'm not made any clearer about what anyone believes by using those kind of pejoratives in a kind of loose way.
You can hear the music, so we can get back to what Paul had to say or move on or talk more about George Maloney, if you'd like, or when we come back. But we do have to take this break. Right back with more Flannel Panel on Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. One point Paul made that we do get folks call quite a bit or email or text or send a letter has to do with the Speaker, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and the President of the United States, Joe Biden, both of whom are Catholic, that they should be excommunicated for their stance on abortion. The other day, Archbishop Shep Hugh said about President Biden that he had left communion with the Catholic Church. But the question about excommunication is a question of canon law and the decisions of bishops. So that isn't, I don't want to get too much in the details about that. But it does seem to me that there is, I mean, if I'm, you know, I don't know, shacking up with my girlfriend, I have left communion with the Catholic Church. I can't go to communion. I can't present my. If I take a position that killing innocents is noble in the public sphere, then I can't present myself for communion. That seems very, very basic to me. It seems obvious. But it's very American to think, no, we are entitled to communion. I don't see that in other cultures as much as I see it in my fellow Americans, but we do have the idea that we are entitled to communion. And so we don't exclude ourselves often when we should. But I want to go back to the Tolkien thing because you have more to say on this. Todd Agliolaro, one of our guests. If you don't know Todd, he's the director of publishing here at Catholic Answers. And if you have an old dusty manuscript under the bed, he wants to see it. Get it out, because boy, he loves it when people send him manuscripts. You were talking about the during the break a little more, and I wanted you to make those points on the air about Tolkien and fascism.
Well, I just wanted to do right by this NPR report because it just seems so off the wall, and maybe it is in the final analysis, but just doing a little more research on this, I guess in Italy, according to this New York Times report, there has been a cultivation, as this article puts it, of the fantasy genre by what it calls the far right, uh-huh. and that... The political sides in Italian politics and culture that identify that way see in The Lord of the Rings and like epic fantasies a vision of spirituality against materialism, a metaphysical vision of life against forms of the modern world. And of course, we too, devotees of Tolkien, do see some of that and find that laudable. But I guess maybe in Italy they do take it a little too far. They co-opt the Tolkien mythos a little bit and put it to the service of a political agenda that Tolkien himself probably wouldn't have signed off on. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. All right.
But if
so, I did a little bit of reading over the break. So this is 90 seconds worth of research. And what I did is
Joe, wait a second. 90 seconds worth of research is like 5 minutes of radio for Joe. Like he can do 90 seconds of research and produce many times more than that of commentary on the research. Go ahead, Joe.
I'm honestly not sure if this is a compliment or an insult. But so I'll just say what I did is I when I do a Google search, when you get a bunch of like now everyone's saying Maloney, far right, Lord of the Rings. So I put in search parameters and I in Google and only look for things published up till 2021. That way none of this is gonna be the Maloney stuff. Just to see, is anyone making these connections? And the first like two pages of results are all about this Italian pastry chef who wanted to live as a hobbit. Amazing. But at the end of the second page, there was an article explaining how while in most Western countries, Tolkien had become, they called it the Bible of the hippies, that in Italy,
oh, yeah,
it
right.
it's kind of a right-wing movement, partly because the Italian version of the book has a preface by a philosopher named Zola, who argues that it's a perennial philosophy being articulated. So in other words, the Italian version actually has like a preface shaping how it's been interpreted,
oh.
which I didn't realize.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the way even this article is presenting it is that it was a group of people who were anti-Nazi, but also anti-socialist and anti-American capitalism. I'm not sure the term for that.
It's fascist? It's,
yeah. I mean, now maybe, again, there may well have been fascistic or fascist glamorizing elements. Part of the problem with like a nationalist movement when you've had Mussolini in your recent past is people might look to him for like the good old days. So it's easy to make the jump from nationalistic to fascist if part of the nationalist movement has been fascist.
Well,
kind of playing word association.
Well, the equating of nationalism and fascism does come from the fact that communism is an internationalist movement and fascism is always a nationalist movement. But that doesn't mean right. that all internationalism is communism, and it doesn't mean that all nationalism is fascism. I can't believe how smart that was, what I just said.
Well, no, that was very well said, especially because Maloney's pointing out that like the modern international thing isn't really the global spread of communism. The modern international thing is the spread of iPhones and consumerism.
Consumerism,
and, like,
yeah.
That's the thing that's destroying national structures and cultures.
Right.
It's this kind of rampant consumerism. Now, you would think there'd be people on the left who would say, oh, yeah, like we actually agree with all of that. But instead, it's just demonized because she likes Lord of the Rings.
I'm going to move on from whether reading The Lord of the Rings makes you fascist, but I did just the way you just spoke about that, Joe, made me realize if reading The Lord of the Rings makes you fascist, then Led Zeppelin are the most fascist people in the world. All of their songs, well, not all of their songs, but a good 50% are about hobbits and elves and The Lord of the Rings.
Is that true? I had no idea. Although they also have an immigrant song that sort of compares immigrants to Vikings.
I'm not exactly sure what they're saying. I'm not sure what the underlying message of immigrant song is, but now I've got it in my head. Thank you for that, Joe. But no, a lot of Vikings and hobbits in Led Zeppelin. So clearly, fascist.
They're named after the Hindenburg. That was German in Germany. The pieces are falling in place.
I mean, the word Zeppelin itself. That's a German name.
It's getting suspicious.
It's all falling into place for me now. If you want to get involved in this conversation, I don't know why you would at this point, but you're welcome. 888-318-7884. There's a lot of reporting on this survey of priests in the United States that recently came out. So I want to ask you both about what you made of it. My reading about it comes from The Pillar, which you can find at pillarcatholic.com. U.S. priests are flourishing, but they don't trust their bishops. Why one bishop said a new report on priests is an examination of conscience. That's how the headline and the subhead in The Pillar. You both are familiar with this study. What do you make of it?
Mm-hmm. I wondered at first if it was, there was several pieces to it, and I took them differently. The flourishing part is real encouraging, of course. I wondered if the seeming disconnect between the self-reported flourishing on the part of the priests and the criticism of their bosses, the bishops, could be a kind of generational conflict.
I was wondering about that too.
Yeah. So the priests are the priests, maybe the first generation of the
JP2
maybe the second.
Priests?
Yeah, exactly. Do we have a single thought here with two minds?
I think we do. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So, okay, so the priests, in other words, are, because I mean, bishops are, because of their job, going to be generally older than their priests. So you're saying that we got these JP2 priests answering things saying, I'm so happy being a priest, and we can all thank God for that. But their bishops were appointed by a different pope.
I think probably there's overlap there too, but it's not a stark divide, but it's probably close enough that could be a factor.
Mm-hmm. And are you also thinking that some of these bishops were formed in a different way than their priests were?
Yeah, you know, the older I get, the more I lose track of what age other people are and where.
Everybody's just got out of high school. That's the way they look to me now.
So I'm not sure without doing some math on my fingers when those bishops were put through seminary and.
Right.
Did they, how many of them had formative years during the tumult after the council and that sort of thing? But I think it lines up.
Yeah, I think it does as well. So the fact that they're flourishing, though, I mean, except for a very small percentage, priests are really happy being priests. I was actually surprised to hear that.
Yeah, I wondered how to square that with, I think the stats were something like 40% of them also said they feel burnt out. So
yeah.
I found that a little bit contradictory. But I guess that's life, right?
It's like moms. They'd probably say, I'm really happy being a mom, but I'm burned out.
Yeah, no, I guess that shouldn't be too surprising then. But it was, on the whole, quite encouraging, as you say.
What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, I think a lot of what you said there. I think the other thing, and I think the way the study is presented is meant to provoke this question, is what has been kind of the effect of the Dallas Charter and all the actions taken in response to the abuse scandal? Because one of the major findings that repeatedly came up was that bishops faced with abusive priests would just move them to another parish where they would do it again. And the response, in a lot of cases, was for the bishops, frankly, to sort of throw priests under the bus with it. When this is a problem with the bishops and their lack of leadership. And so instead, they just adopted the zero tolerance policies and everything. And I think those policies on the whole are very good. And in the study, the priests themselves seem to say they thought these were good, but 40% of them also thought they went too far. And I think the reason for that is I think priests are a little nervous that if they find themselves in a situation, certainly anything involving sexuality, or abuse of any kind, but really even anything where it just is maybe they make some embarrassing decision. I think a lot of priests wonder now if the bishop will have their back. And maybe he shouldn't. But I think that the danger is that there's a loss of that sense of episcopal fatherhood. And it's hard
Without question. That's just been when you have this kind of legalistic fear on everybody's part, and you just, there's no room for a mistake. How can that foster a fatherly relationship?
Yeah, a couple of things there. With regard to, you mentioned the Dallas Charter and the scandals that we're still processing. I think it was in the report something to the effect of a dissatisfaction that priests who are accused of some kind of misconduct are handled with one set of rules and bishops with a different set.
Oh, yeah.
And and priests are disciplined with a much stricter set of disciplines, even than bishops who were found guilty of things or credibly accused. So there seems to be a disgruntledness on the part of priests over that. And I think that that certainly is connected with, but different from, I think, maybe the most salient point of all that you made there, Joe, that there's a lack of fatherhood. So the number of priests who said they would not go to their bishop to talk about a problem or to confide in them or to, as a son would to a father, or to go for spiritual counseling, and that bishops are just basically middle managers. They're bean counters. They're bookkeepers. They're...
Yeah. But would either of you entertain this possibility that we're not a good percentage of the time the church is choosing the wrong men to be bishops?
I mean, I think the results speak for themselves in some cases.
But I wonder why that is. I mean, I do think our image of what a bishop is supposed to be is off. We're
the convention.
I think we want bean counters and administrators. That's what we want. That's what we're asking for.
So I think if you were to do the... Oh, sorry, John, I've got a long answer, so you can go first.
Well, the best conventional wisdom I've heard on this is that the sort of man who rises to the level of the episcopacy is one who knows how to play his cards very subtly, and he exhibits a set of qualities that get him promoted, but these are not the same qualities that make a good shepherd.
Yeah, if you want, you can call it like the Elena Kagan effect. So Elena Kagan, when she was having the Supreme Court nomination process, there was no public record of her having any thought about anything. She had so carefully guarded whatever her own thoughts were that people could only guess what she believed in.
Yeah, because that's the strategy. If you want to be a judge.
The process had become so harshly judging that those who got ahead are those who just keep a tight lip about anything. That was kind of the thinking. And the danger is that we do this with bishops as well. So I was going to say the kind of the 100-year view of this is like this. I mean, there was a long period where bishops saw themselves in a lot of ways as being sort of middle management. And Vatican II really pushes hard against that and says bishops are not just vicars of the Pope, that they're supposed to be successors of the apostles in their own right. And after that, there was a desire to get really prophetic priests to become bishops. So I think Jadot, the papal nuncio under Paul VI in the early days of John Paul II, got a lot of people who were really like social justice warrior priests.
Boy, did he. Yeah.
Thinking that these would be prophetic. And they were, not in all cases, but disproportionately a disaster. Not, I mean, on almost every level, the scandals with them, the egos, the narcissism, the inability to manage a budget or run a diocese.
The covering up sexual abuse.
The covering up of sexual abuse, right. The carefully maintaining a public image rather than actually striving for holiness. And
why are you reading Rembrandt Weeklund's curriculum vitae here? I don't understand. What did we get onto?
That's 80. That's over 80. Yeah.
But the point is, like, that was kind of the dabbling in the world of let's find bold, visionary kind of bishops. It was so bad. I think we were just like, well, let's get the guys who know canon law and know how to do a spreadsheet. And the problem is, like, yeah, they're not going to have the big scandal, usually. But they're also maybe not going to inspire vocations or holiness or... Again, I mean, I'm painting very much with broad brushes, and I don't mean to actually besmirch people who might find themselves in either of those groups.
No.
But there is that sort of going for a unremarkable personality because the remarkable personalities made headlines in a bad way.
Yeah, and I also want to add that because all three of us know absolutely wonderful priests who are bishops, priests who have become bishops. And so it works sometimes. It's just the percentages, it just doesn't seem like it's working at a high enough percentage rate. But, there's the Jesus wasn't perfect in his, I mean, he was perfect, but his record wasn't perfect on the choice of apostles. So it's apparently very hard.
We're now screening for new Catholic Answers host after Psychelic.
That didn't
Jesus
come out quite
perfect.
The way I wanted it to come out. But let me ask you this.
Try to fix what you were saying.
No.
That Jesus chooses very imperfect men.
Yeah.
And he did that in the first century and he does it now.
Yeah.
So if our standard is we want sinless bishops, We're not going to get that. And we've never gotten that.
Yeah.
And Jesus didn't promise us that. And he didn't give us that.
But I have a radical solution.
No, that doesn't mean we can't have something better. No, I think so. Figure 11 in this Catholic university study is really putting the numbers on what we said. That when they asked bishops how they saw themselves and they asked priests how they saw their bishops. And 70% of bishops said they saw themselves as a father to their priests, compared to 28% of the priests.
Yeah.
And it's shocking.
So we need something like marriage encounter for them. I mean, we need some kind of retreat for you to all go on and work this out, because that's not good.
Yeah, the only one that diocesan priests were more likely to see their bishops as than the bishops were was administrator.
Yeah.
The only, like, so they asked about brother, father, coworker, servant, shepherd, administrator. And the only two titles that a majority of priests bid on were shepherd and administrator.
But
all of the more intimate ones, and servant and father and coworker, none of those. There was a total sense of isolation.
That's awful.
And the numbers are dismal. And it I mean, look, 28%, 34%, that's the range we're looking at there. There are clearly a lot of good bishops in the bunch there, but it also is clearly more than just a few bad apples that we're dealing with here. There is a real problem in terms of that breakdown.
I want to propose a solution to this, but we have to take a break. So I'll propose the solution, and then you guys can shoot it down when we come back on the other side of the break. Allow the priests of a diocese to have some say in who's selected as their bishop. And I mean officially have some say in who's selected as their bishop. We'll take a break. We'll come right back and get a response to that suggestion right after this.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, a very large survey of Catholic priests in the United States and Catholic bishops in the United States reveals two striking things. One, priests are very satisfied in their work. They report that they are flourishing, which is extraordinarily good news. The other bit of news that comes out of this survey is these very same priests don't feel very close to and don't feel that they have much reason to trust their bishops. My proposal, let the priests have more say in the choice of bishops. Gentlemen, start tearing me down. No, go ahead.
Well, one of the initial problems that occurs to me in doing that is they're choosing from among their own, and wouldn't you have a lot of campaigning and competing among those candidates? And maybe that would be a healthy thing. I don't know.
No, I was going to say not only that, but you also have like priest groups that form, like fraternity groups among priests in a diocese. And
clicks.
If one member of your fraternity group who knows all of your sins and your struggles and everything becomes your bishop, that's a very awkward spot to be put in. So I think the dynamic is just fundamentally different between like the fraternity between priests and the relationship a priest has to his bishop. And there's a difference between the internal and external forum. And so to have a guy move from internal forum to external forum, I mean, imagine if your regular confessor became the boss of Catholic Answers.
Yeah,
you'd be like, well, never talking to you again, or you know, you're just like,
but
that, and not in a bad way, just like recognizing those boundaries.
Well, what if, but say now the way the system works allegedly is there's consultations that are done secretly. Three names are proposed by the nuncio to the Pope. You can correct me if I'm wrong about how the system is currently working. the Pope chooses from among those three names or says, bring me other
actually,
names.
Three names are well, multiple names are sent to the Congregation for Bishops, who then create the terna and then give their preference. And the Pope can accept any of those three or reject them all.
But why not give that power to the priest as well? Why not say, here's three names for the priests, and the priest can eliminate names that they don't want?
Yeah, I think it could work. I think the danger is still this danger that it becomes too political among the priests.
We could have super PACs among the laity. We could have Catholic church super PACs.
Yeah, exactly. Run some ads.
Yeah, we could run ads in the bulletin.
Think about bulletin sales would go through the roof. Like,
imagine Catholic Answers Live. They could advertise on Catholic Answers Live. We'd make a killing.
Oh, my goodness.
I'd suggest an alternative that maybe accomplishes something similar, but just have a lot more bishops.
Praise God. Somebody said a sensible thing. I've been waiting for one of you to. I am so supportive of that. Please continue with that thought. Well, I support that completely.
If you have bishops with, if you have dioceses with scores or hundreds of priests, it's just almost a physical impossibility, A, for the bishop to be a father to them all, but even in the larger execution of his job to be a teacher, governor, and sanctifier of so many people.
Right.
Why? It probably only worsens the condition of their being administrators first rather than pastors.
I am 100% in this court. I know that it brings trouble. I know that part of the problem, the argument is, well, that makes it harder on the church's finances because large dioceses can do things financially that small dioceses can't. I don't think that in the end is a dispositive argument at all. And how many people were in St. Peter's congregation in Rome when he was the Bishop of Rome? I'm sure that there were, you know, local communities within the city of Rome, but I mean, the largest diocese in the world, Mexico City, it's more than 10 million Catholics with one cardinal archbishop. I mean, and then they have, associate bishops as well, like they do here in Los Angeles. That doesn't seem to me it seems to me we have departed from the model that Christ himself gave us. He didn't give us a model of 10 million Catholics under one bishop.
Yeah, this comes up in all places in the debate about whether to have First Communion or Confirmation first. Because the reason we do Confirmation so late is because the bishop does Confirmation, and it just is logistically very difficult for him to confirm all the babies in the diocese.
Right.
Because there's too many babies for the number of bishops. But it does seem like this would solve that as well. When you look, there were 318 bishops at the First Council of Nicaea, 325. That's just Eastern bishops who were there. That's not every bishop in the world. That's just the ones who were able to show up for the council. 300. Now, in comparison, there are right now 5,600 bishops in the world today.
Good Lord.
So that's 17 times as many, something like that. I don't know if that math is right.
Yeah, but the world at the time of the Council of Nicaea, the entire population of the world is something like 200 million people. The Christian population
exactly.
of the world is what, 20 million people? Maybe 20
right.
million people?
And so the population is like, what is that, 500 times?
Oh, let's do math on
I
the
was
air.
Told there'd
people
be no math
enjoy
math.
That,
show.
That always yeah, makes
exactly.
a good. No, but I,
but
I,
all that's to say, like right. statistically, I think you're right, that the number of bishops, you had a much closer bishop to congregant ratio. And so it's like with imagine a business. If you start a business in your garage, you're going to be doing a lot of the tinkering and a lot of the work yourself. If that business explodes and it becomes, you know, the next
Amazon.
Apple or whatever, yeah, you're going to be not doing a lot of the hands-on frontline work, and you shouldn't be. But the problem is, and so that works at the global church. Like, it makes sense that the Pope is not regularly running just like the local parish down the block. But a bishop, you could have it set up where they are much closer to their people, and I think you have much more of that direct fatherly leadership.
What would you think of what we now call a deanery became a diocese? A deanery being
it's
something
still
like
too big.
You think it's still too big? 12 to 20 parishes usually in a deanery, something like that. You don't, you think that's
yeah, I mean, it
great
could work.
Progress?
It could work. Depending on the area, it would be. It would be progress.
It's a
Todd Aguilaro is here. He's, so far, he's winning because he came up with the best idea. But we got a, still an hour to go of flannel panel. Joe Heschmeyer also here. Also, again, not wearing a flannel shirt. I'm Cy Keller, your host. We're covering the news of the day from a Catholic perspective. We got some great calls on. So if you're on the line, hang on. We're going to, I think your chances are way above 15% now. We're going to try to get you on. We will take a very quick break and be right back with more Flannel Panel on Catholic Answers Live right after this.